This episode of the Joe Rogan Experience podcast is a bonus episode. We had no idea we were even going to be able to do this as recently as yesterday, you fucks. Okay? We're making it happen. So the only sponsor is onnit.com. That's O-N-N-I-T. Use the code name Rogan. Save yourself 10% off any and all supplements. Shortest commercial ever. Cue the music. Justin, the Viking, Ren is in the house to tell us about some amazing adventures. It's going to be educational, enriching, good for the soul.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan podcast by night, all day.
Justin Ren, first of all, thanks for doing this. I'm so glad we could fit you in. I was a little worried we weren't going to be able to get you before you got back to the Congo, because you're on this kind of a whirlwind thing. You know, you're back at L.A. for only like a few days, right?
Actually, I head out to Vegas after this, and then I'm driving there, and I fly out tomorrow, so...
For those who don't know, Justin was a contestant on The Ultimate Fighter. He's a mixed martial arts fighter in the heavyweight division for the UFC. And then I started reading some stuff. I think the first thing I read about it was on The Underground, which is mixedmartialarts.com. It's this great website that we both belong to.
Yep.
It's probably the best mixed martial arts message board in the country, in the world, really. And there was a thread where it was talking about you going over there and helping people in the Congo and working with these pygmies, and this had become something you were really, really devoted to. And I was like, wow, like, who saw that coming? Like, check this guy out. I saw a picture of you before that with a pig that you had killed with a knife over your shoulder. Yeah. You know, I'm like, this guy's a fucking savage. He's got a pig over his shoulder.
A Viking.
There's a picture of you with this wild hog over your shoulder. I'm like, I want to party with Justin Ren. And the next thing you know, you go from there and you're a mixed martial arts fighter, hog killer, pygmy saver. I mean, you're over there helping all these people in the Congo. How did all this get started?
Man, I just heard about how much they were suffering, and I had no clue. Like, I wanted to fight against people, you know, and I wanted my dreams, my everything. And then when I heard about the pygmies, I just heard the suffering that they were going through. I heard that they felt forgotten. I heard that they were enslaved. I heard that the 4 out of 10 is the small stat that you can find. 4 out of 10 of their children die before age 5. And so for me, I was just like, man, that's brutal. And I knew that they were not given citizenship in their own country. And so I just went there to just learn and see and sit with them, live with them, sit around the campfire. That's where I've learned most. Whenever the slave masters aren't around, whenever those guys are asleep, then they'll really open up and tell you what everything's happening. And so it was just a ton of suffering. And that's how I went over there. I just went with a burden to find out what was going on.
Could you put that a little closer to
Yeah, absolutely.
How did you find out about it at first? What was the... What led you to this?
I had a buddy that was having a plan to go to the Congo, and he was going all by himself. And I mean, just completely, utterly alone. And it was like the worst conflict zone on the planet. And heard about what he was doing, heard about what was happening with the pygmies, and heard his wife was a little worried that he was going. And I just was looking for something with purpose and passion. And I felt like I could be passionate about fighting for people. And so I went with him and heard all the terrible stuff that was going on. And we went there to see what we could do to help.
Wow, that's so inspiring. And for folks who haven't seen it, there's a video that Justin did that's gone viral, and this has really brought a lot of attention to your cause and what you're doing. There's a video of you with these young pygmy children that are – is this the first time they're seeing a white man?
To preface the video, this is actually not the pygmies, the video.
Oh, okay.
It's actually the Bantu. And the Bantu are the tribe that's actually enslaving the pygmies.
Oh, my God.
And so it was, around some of the pygmies. But this was the least remote location. Like, you'll see that there wasn't many trees. Where I went was 85 kilometers deep in the jungle, where you couldn't even see the sky because the canopy of the rainforest is so tall.
Wow.
And so this was the Bantu people. And the Bantu people are the ones that enslaved them. It was actually a gift, because that video to me is a real gift. It shows me, even though I hated their parents, you know, you can't even see that in the video, that I actually just had a hatred in my heart towards the parents of these kids. But yeah, so that was brutal, because on the UG also, I posted a video, or actually a thread about how I buried a 1.5-year-old in the Congo, and his name was Andy Bo. And so this video that's playing right now, you can't even tell that they were that their parents are responsible for the grave that I dug, I think, 2 days before that video.
So these are the Bantu people? Is that what
Bantu. B-A-N-T-U.
And the Bantu people are enslaving the Pygmies, and this has been going on for how long?
It's actually rather recent. I mean, there's been types of it for hundreds of years, but they have different kinds of slavery within the Pygmies. There's ones that they're held to gunpoint. There's by the rebels in the gold and coltan and diamond mines. And then there's other ones where they're in shackles. But then the ones that we've actually, I didn't get to say that yet, but we've actually set some slaves free. Some Pygmy slaves that were from the Bantu, and we negotiated with the Bantu people who go up and they buy up the land from underneath the Pygmies. Pygmies don't have a way to make any monetary gain. They don't get paid anything in money. They get paid sometimes corn, sometimes bags of salt, sometimes bars of soap, like a bar of soap for 2 days of work. They might get a bar of soap to bathe with. And so, yeah, the Bantu people are the ones that are enslaving them, that we're actually negotiating with them to free them.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a crazy environment that must be. The Congo itself, yeah. Not being able to see the sky and having all this insane conflict going on underneath the canopy of these trees. Also primitive, dealing with things like slavery.
Yeah.
And forcing people, what's really crazy is forcing people to work in the mines to create the very things that we need to power our most technologically advanced pieces of electronics, like these laptops.
Yeah.
That coltan, right?
Yeah, coltan, I think 80 to 90% of it is found in the Congo. So it's only found in two places in the world. 80 to 90% of it's the Congo. 100% of it's rebel-owned. There's not a legit mine. And so
that's insane. Yeah,
most of it's Pygmy slave mined.
100% of it is rebel-owned.
From the Congo, yes. The Democratic Republic of Congo, all of it is rebel-owned.
So there is no karma-free cell phones, electronics.
No, not smartphones, not Macs, not flat-screen TVs. Wow. So, I mean, I support it even. I have the Apple products, yeah. iPad, iPhone. Everything.
What a bizarre, fascinating sort of statement on humanity that is.
Yeah, it's actually pretty crazy, man, because I had some Pygmies come one time and give me some coltan. I didn't know what it was, though, at the time. I didn't know. I knew that there was gold and diamond mines there and that they were slaves in those, but I had no clue what coltan was. And that was after my first trip, but they actually put some coltan in my hands and I was holding it. And they were really excited to give it to me. You know, this is why they're slaves. And so they thought I'd be ecstatic. And so I'm having to ask my translator, like, what is this stuff they're handing me? I didn't know if it was like rough diamonds or if deep inside there was gold or what it was, but it was coltan.
What does it look like?
It's like this black, dark mineral. It's almost, some of it almost looks like a crystal, or I don't know if you can throw
like
up a
coal?
Picture. Almost like coal. Yeah, almost like coal. It's long and jaggedy. It's kind of I don't know, you know those like crystals that you used to be able to buy, like that are long like that. It'd be a black one of those almost. And sometimes it has more of a coal, like charcoal kind of feature to it. And it's heavy, but it's a great conduit for electricity. And that's why we're using it in all our smartphones and everything. And that's why they're slaves. But I wasn't excited about it and I didn't know what it was. And but for them, you know, think how crazy that is. That's why they're slaves.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what it is.
Yeah.
And they're just ecstatic to give it to me.
Meanwhile, it's a huge source. I mean, you need it all over the world.
Yeah.
And most people are completely ignorant as to what it is and especially where it comes from.
Right.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. Like, I had explained that to someone when they were talking about how much better it is to have an electric car. And I'm like, do you understand that car is filled with conflict minerals?
Yeah.
Like, it's not that simple. It's not as simple as, like, you're good and the guy with the gas guzzler is bad. Like, no, there's a lot of fuckery in creation of your car. Batteries, like lithium ion, that's another reason why we're in Afghanistan. There's lithium stores. There's trillions of dollars of lithium in Afghanistan. And that's what you need for lithium ion batteries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's insane. I can't even... I know we have 2 hours, but I don't even know if I could get into some of the stuff. I know that Shane from Vice has been on here, and then someone was saying someone
He's
else
on
from
here
Vice
again tomorrow.
Is he really?
Yeah.
Man, I wish I could meet that dude. He's a cool guy.
You want to meet him? If he could stay until tomorrow, you can meet him.
All right, we'll have to see about my plane. Bump it back or something.
You can move it back. Yeah. He'd be happy to meet you, man. Yeah, that'd be great. He's the coolest motherfucker on earth.
Dude, I think he's awesome.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's super easy to talk to, too. Just really, like, down to earth.
Cool, yeah, and he goes to some of the craziest places.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, he's returning back and forth, you know. Yeah.
I wonder what he'd think about me going for a full year. Just, I know that he said it was a crazy time going there, and I just would want to pick his brain what part he went to.
Is that what you're doing now? You're about to go for a year?
For a full year, yeah. Wow. I'm going to go for a full year, and I'm partnering with the oldest university in the Congo. And they have been working on this project for 7 years. And we kind of just linked up together to where our visions just are kind of the same. We want to free these people and give them a sustainable ways of life. So I'm one of my best friends now, was born and raised in the Congo, was educated, got his doctorates in Australia, but then he came back to the Congo and he's the dean of the School of Community Development. So he teaches them different ways of agriculture, water wells, all these kinds of things. So he's actually setting them free. That's what we did in September. We saw 60 slaves be set free, put on 30 acres of land and get a water well. Now it's doubled. Now, since I've been back here, it's been 120 slaves set free, men, women, and children put on 60 acres of land. And then now, you know, we're wanting to find a way. We think that me going there for a year, and if we were able to fundraise $50,000, so if we could find 1,000 people at $50, 1,000 people at $50, that's 1,000 slaves freedom. Wow. And it's a nuts amount of stuff that would do.
How many people are slaves right now there?
Well, the pygmies in the Democratic Republic of Congo, there's a few different, it's hard for them to do a census, you know? I mean, these are hunters and gatherers and nomads and then slaves and then in dangerous areas and then really remote areas. So there's a few different censuses and, that they've tried to do. The lowest I've seen is 300,000 pygmies. And then another I've seen is 600,000. And pygmy actually literally translated means elbow height. So, I mean, they're smaller than everybody else. It's almost like they're just the worst bullying victims that have ever been. Wow. So the average men's height is 4'7".
So are they in any way like, have you ever seen any of that stuff on the Hobbit people from this island of...
The remains they found?
No, yeah, they found remains of people that lived, you know, tens of thousands of years ago with humans, and they were the real tiny, like almost people-like things.
Right.
It's really interesting when you see like someone like the pygmies where you have like a whole race of them that are like really tiny like that. It makes you wonder like how did that separate strain branch off way, way, way back in the day in the evolutionary chain of these people being developed. It's really odd.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, actually one of the problems that they have is that they're called half man, half animal by the surrounding tribes. And wow. So that's one reason why I've met people that have been, that their families, members of their families have been victim of cannibalism. And so, yeah, I've had pictures that sent your guys of cannibalism. They actually, the surrounding tribes believe that if you can consume the flesh of a pygmy, that you can gain superhuman strength. I mean, from taking the genitals off of small boys and putting them under businesses, it'll bring you wealth. From eating their flesh. Yeah, the rebels believe that if you eat their flesh, that you can, what is it? It makes you not bulletproof, but what is it whenever a bullet can just fly right through you? So basically, not invisible, but
impervious.
Yeah. So it just, that's what they believe.
They you take can just, children's genitals and they put them under a business?
Yeah, that's what they'll do to them. And they'll think that brings them many blessings. That some of the witch doctors have done that in Uganda, but they do it in Congo. The part of the Congo that I'm going to is it borders Rwanda and Uganda. And so I'm right over the border and then in the jungle, kind of Bunia is where Shalom University is. And then 85 kilometers from there, there's a part of the Congo called Commander. They say it differently than that. But then we go from there deep into the jungle. And where that is, there's some different rebel groups that have done just brutal stuff there. And that's some of their beliefs.
Wow. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. How the fuck does one place get so messed up?
What's so crazy, man, is they should be the richest country on the entire face of this planet. They have every element on the periodic table, every single one.
Right.
And they have the most fertile soil. They have gold, diamonds, now coltan. With all this taken off, they should really be the richest country there is.
And
all the corruption and everything just ruins it.
It's so crazy. The corruption is so nuts. The warlords and the whole system that they've got going on down there. It's so bizarre to look at. you know, United States of America here in 2013, how everything is, and then realize there's another part of the world that exists in the same time that is essentially living the way people lived thousands of years ago with guns, though.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's so crazy is the Pygmies. I actually have my grandpa's I've been accepted as family there now. And I have my grandpa, Jailua, is his name, Jailua. And he gave me his bow. So his Pygmy bow and arrow that he's had for 30, 40 years.
Can you hold it in your hands?
It's actually pretty tiny, man. It's pretty tiny. But in it, it has all these things that are almost like a Pygmy tally mark. And it's all up and down the top of the bow and the bottom of the bow on the inside. And it's all the kills that he has of certain types of antelope. And he gave me the I think I have like 10 arrows, five with like the metal on it, and then four that are just straight wood that are sharpened, and they have this like circular thing around the tip of it. And I thought the ones that are metal would be the ones for the antelope because they look like they would do more damage. But it's actually the ones that don't have the metal on it that are just carved out of the wood that are the ones that go after the antelope because they dip the tips of them in poison. And so it's poison-dipped arrows, and those are the ones they go after with the biggest ones. And the metal ones are more for, like, monkeys and small little pigs and things like that.
Wow. So you're going to go there and live with these people in, like, a tent made out of leaves.
Yeah, it's a twig. A twig and leaf hut, man.
You should pull the – do people see the picture? Do you have it on your website or anything? Did you send any of those pictures?
Yeah, I sent some of the pictures over. Yeah, it's a twig and leaf hut, and they rebuild them basically every night.
Every night?
Well, it depends on if it was raining, the rainforest, and then if it's if the wind is blowing. I actually have pictures of, I think, like the widows and orphans that lived in one hut together where just in the middle of the night, it didn't even rain that night, but the wind blew and their whole roof came off. And so they have to go get the leaves again and place them over, banana leaves and different like those big elephant-looking ear leaves.
Right.
And so they just get those and they cover up. In nine different villages I went to last time, I was there for a month, and nine different villages I went to, not one of them ever owned a blanket. Wow. So they're just sleeping straight on the dirt, man. That's it.
And no blankets. No blankets.
No. Just sleeping straight on the dirt.
Wow.
First time I went to one of those tribes was I saw the chief and I was putting up my tent and they about lost it and I had a little air up mattress, you know, and I had a sleeping bag. And I mean, to them, that was the Ritz-Carlton. So I let the chief have it and I
slept. Let the chief have it? That's amazing.
Yeah. So I let him have that and I slept in his hut. And,
wow.
Yeah. And then,
was he psyched?
Yeah, he was, man. And they all passed around the air up mattress and that they were actually like holding it up above them, almost like what crowd surfing, like crowd surfing at a concert, but they're doing that with the air up mattress so everyone could feel it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So they've never had mattresses. I mean, this isn't like a new thing to them. They've slept on dirt forever.
Yeah. I haven't come across one pygmy in the remote locations that I've been to.
Pygmies in other locations that have cities or anything like that? Or?
No. They're actually basically, if they come to a city at all, so yeah, there we go. That would be home sweet home for a full year. That's the kind of villages that I'm staying in. And if you look in there, I think on top of one of those huts, there's like a few clothes. And if a pygmy's had clothes, they've been a slave. So there's basically the only pygmies that are there. Yeah, so there's some of the clothes. So obviously these ones have been slaves. And most of the ones I've ever been to have been slaves. There's only been like one village I've been to where they were so remote that they still weren't enslaved and they could be hunters and gatherers. But the deforestation with the trees falling that you could drive two Mack trucks through, those are scaring all the animals away to where they basically can no longer live like hunters and gatherers because the animals just flee from all the trees falling.
So is it loggers? Is that what it is?
It's loggers, but it's also the guys that are like the Bantu, the slave masters. They can get the pygmies, their slaves, to go cut these trees down. And to pygmies, trees are holy. They believe that the ancestors of their ancestors live inside the trees, become trees, and they bury their dead inside holes inside of trees. They find an opening in it. They'll put their dead there. And so they're having to cut down what they've lived in for thousands of years. And then the rainforest preservationists and wildlife conservationists, they push them out. They'll buy up the land. And they'll say pygmies aren't good for this, and they'll kick them off the land, and they'll buy up thousands and thousands of acres, actually thousands of square kilometers.
Preservation people will do this?
Yeah, they'll kick the pygmies off.
So they're more interested in the trees than they are the pygmies?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah, I've heard from my family members in the pygmy tribe, and when I say this, like literally, I have pygmy family that are more family to me than some of my family here in the U.S.
Like and so, that one crazy cousin who gets drunk and grabs your dick?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. There's some pygmies I just love, man, that I love. And,
sure. And do you speak their language?
I don't speak their language yet. I speak some of it, man, but not a lot. And during that year there, for my birthday coming up, I'm going to get Rosetta Stone, I think. And that's what I'm asking
for. How could you not? You're going to live there for a year. You say you love these people. What have they been talking shit about you the whole time? And you're going to learn Pygmy and find out. God,
yeah, well, they don't have a Rosetta Stone in Pygmy. That'd be funny, though. I'm the crazy uncle.
What is the language that they have? Like, what is it called?
Oh, it's like that, right? It's not the clicking, but it's close. It's actually a tonal language or a polyphonic. Actually, there's some sweet videos. I don't know if you guys want to pull any up, but on YouTube, they do a thing that I love called the water drum. And that actually isn't going to be on my YouTube thing, but you could look up Pygmy's Water Drum on YouTube, and there's some sweet songs. They'll have like 7 to 8 women inside the river, and then they each have a part to play, and they just slap the water, and it comes out to beautiful songs. Or they also have something called polyphonic singing, where they each have a tone that they do, and they actually, some people call it the language of song. I was trying to think of that, but their language, sometimes they're joking around with each other or getting into it, and it sounds like they're kind of singing to one another.
Wow.
So that's the ones that are in the more remote locations, the ones that have been slaves for years and years and years. They've started to learn to speak Swahili. So yeah, there it is.
And you're not in it for just the boobs, right?
No, sir. They sag after a while.
Is there a drum to that as well, or is that all just the water?
It's all the water. Yeah, this is just 3. Whenever they get like 8 to 10 in there, they get some intense songs.
This is hilarious.
Take a pause, wipe your eyes.
Wow.
They also have something called the tree drum. They'll hollow out a tree, and they'll get some harder sticks, and they'll just beat the side of a tree, and it's sweet.
So what are you doing for food out there?
The last month I went, I took about 40 to 50, power bars with me.
That's
so,
it.
Man, my bag was so heavy cause I took a supplement shop with me. And, but I mean, they eat caterpillars. I've eaten like, I normally don't ask, the different parts of it, but, whenever they do goat, which actually pygmies don't eat goat, they believe that it has evil spirits inside it. So even though goats are really easy to raise, they won't eat a goat. The hunters say that a goat makes you weak in the knees. And then the women just don't like the flavor of it. And they all think that they've seen evil spirits go inside of them. And so they don't eat goats.
Did they see Drag Me to Hell? Is that what it is? Remember that? Remember the goat becomes evil? Remember that?
I never saw it.
Yeah. It's a good movie.
But yeah, and so they'll eat chicken, whatever they're slaves for. I have a picture, I think, of my buddy Harry, and we call him Harry because he's the only pygmy I've ever seen with facial hair. That's why that video was so unique about me, because I went over there, and it wasn't just like some guy from America that went there.
Giant white hairy dude.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck is all this?
Yeah, that's why my buddy started calling me the Great White Sasquatch.
What do they think about your tattoos?
Oh, yeah, that is crazy. Not to the pygmies. The pygmies actually tattoo their faces sometimes. The women, I've come across a few of them that are more like traditional or remote. Those women still carve their teeth. I don't know if you can Google that, but they actually carve their teeth, and makes them almost look more like a piranha. To me, it's not attractive, but to the pygmy men, it's attractive.
Really?
Yeah. They
maybe
carve
pygmy
their teeth
men
like that.
Hate blowjobs. Like, I hate it. No, man. Yeah, I don't even want to be oh, those teeth. Good. Perfect. My girl.
I don't know if you guys can find a picture of that, but it's pretty crazy looking whenever they smile.
There's a lot of strange things that, oh my God, that African people do to customize their body. The neck rings, that's very strange. The stretching of the lower lip that the Suri women do. They put a plate in their lower lip.
Yeah. The Maasai, they do their big gauges in their ears.
Yeah.
And whenever they get so big that they start flopping around. I've actually been... brought into so the pygmy tribe brought me in as family. The Maasai tribe had a ceremony and made me a warrior, and they painted me red head to toe. They gave me a spear that killed 2 lions.
Whoa.
I've actually seen the mane of the lion that it killed. The head warrior, you know, gave me my name, which is Mzungu Simba Maasai Maran. And that means the white lion, Maasai warrior. So I'm a part of the warrior class of the Maasai. And whenever the wind blows with them and those big gauges, They'll just twist their earlobes and then wrap them around the top of their ear. So it looks really funny, but that's just on a windy day.
So they kill lions with spears?
Mm-hmm.
Is it because the lions are attacking them, or just they just go out to be gangster?
A little bit of both.
Really?
I think the younger guys go out there to impress the girls, but...
To kill a fucking lion with a spear?
Yeah.
Isn't there a way to just show your dick?
Those are shepherds. So the pygmies are hunter and gatherers, but the Maasai are shepherds. And so they take care of different cattle and goats. And so whenever they're doing that, they have to protect, their herd. And that's against lions and jaguar or, cheetahs and, leopards. And so my spear, they actually showed me the skin of the leopard that it killed, the mane of the lion that it killed. And he also said it killed a man, so I guess I have a murder weapon. But
holy shit!
Yeah, but he was protecting their cattle. A thief came in there and actually came with a rungu, which is a club. And so it was a rungu versus a spear, and it was a warrior. So, anyways, it's pretty crazy.
Wow, what is it like? What kind of a head is this thing? The spearhead? What is it like?
The spearhead's about this long, and it's heavy.
Metal?
Yeah, actually, they have this. The wood part of it in the middle of a Maasai warrior spear is from like an olive tree of some sort.
Okay.
And then they put it through the fire and make it really, really strong.
That's a hard wood anyway. Yeah. Olive's a hard wood.
Yeah. And they know how to treat it through the fire and make it like rock solid. And then one end is almost like, looks like a javelin. And so that's the end that they use for either target practice or just sticking it in the ground whenever they're walking around. And the other end they only use for whenever they come across a lion.
Wow. So one end they throw it just to like the... Just to practice.
Yeah, and we took some balloons over there to see if the kids would like it. And to be honest, the warriors liked the balloons better than anything because we'd blow up those balloons and just tie them, throw them on the ground. And then the different warriors would stock the balloons almost on every time, almost the first throw every single time they nailed it.
How far away?
I mean, not too far because the wind's blowing and they're stalking it. And whenever they're going after a lion, they normally wait until they're close because if they miss, you know, they don't want to miss, you know, so they wait till it's close. And so, I mean, probably here to the door, man, only like 20 feet. Well, I guess some of them did it farther where some were getting it from all the way to the window. So some of them could actually throw them pretty good and far.
Sometimes they get jacked when they go after these lions.
Oh yeah. The spear that I have. The guy, the warrior that gave it to me, his name's almost like, it's like Most is his name. It's like Most. And the other warrior, man, I'm slipping on his name. But I took a picture with both of them. And the one guy that I met, he had these teeth marks out of his knee. His kneecap, he had a big rungu, which is a club, but it was like a walking stick for him. And, his knee was really swollen and it had these chunks out of it. And then, I asked him what happened to his knee, and then he pulled over. They always wear red because that way if they're ever wounded in battle or anything hits them, you don't know that they're bleeding. And so he pulled down his shuka, which is like a robe of sort for the warrior class, and he pulled it down, and down his shoulder blade and the back of his like shoulder, he had claw marks. I mean, just wicked claw marks. And so the lion had attached onto his shoulder, onto his thigh, and then bit into his knee. And so he showed me those scars. Yeah, yeah, man. And the head warrior is the one that saved the other warrior. And that's the spear that I have hanging up in my house.
Wow. So as the lion was biting him, homeboy jacked him with the spear.
Yeah, came after him. And this one that wasn't even on a lion hunt. This was just they were going after, or they were tending the fields, tending the flock, and a lion came after the guy.
Dude, fuck cats. That's all I have to say. Fuck all cats.
Yeah, I'm more of a dog guy.
Yeah, I'm way more of a dog guy. I have chickens right now. I just got little baby chicks.
What? That's
yeah,
awesome.
My little girls, they wanted to get chickens, so we decided to get like a little chicken coop sort of situation. But the fucking cat, I have two cats. And my one cat, this motherfucker just paces in front of that door, left and right. Doesn't matter if he's trained. Doesn't matter if he's sweet and he purrs. He can't wait to murder one of those birds. He just can't get it out of his head. Like, in his head, he's got to get in there and fit. He hears them. He sits out in front of the door and meows. And, you know, it's almost like you want to kick his ass. You're like, come on, man. Why don't you fucking leave them alone? They're little chicks. But in his DNA, there is just no stopping that. That's mm-hmm. what he wants to do.
Yep.
Have you ever seen a lion?
Yeah, I've seen two different times. I've seen two. And one time they were sitting over a, it was either Cape Buffalo or a, what is it, a water?
Water buffalo?
Water buffalo. I think it was a water buffalo. And it was still chomping down on that, and so it wasn't paying attention to us. I had my spear, though, and but I wasn't going to test it out. Like, some guys were trying to get me to go over there.
Have you practiced with it?
I have practiced with it, but I'm not going to use it, man. Like, I'm not. They already gave me the ceremony and gave me the spear and made me a warrior. In fact, the other ones, they can't be a warrior until they kill a lion. So they come back with the female tail, waving it, and if it's a male, they come back with the mane wrapped around them. Yeah.
You got to be you have to be a lion killer to be a warrior.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Until then, you're kind of a lesser class male.
You should bring a boomstick.
We're such pussies in this country.
Yeah. So I thought I was a warrior. That's why I try to connect with them. You know, hey, I fought. And they wrestle. They just do takedowns, though. They don't do any, like, ground fighting
or
anything.
Did you show them some moves?
I did. I wrestled two at the same time and picked them both up. And, so they thought, that's how they thought I was a warrior, because they were like, oh, wow, he's wrestling. Like, we can't.
Did you submit
them? They had a line
them?
Of them.
Did you submit anybody? Did you teach them how to tap?
Man, no. For me, I would just pick them up and put them over my shoulder. I did that with both of them at the same time once. You got to remember, they're skinnier dudes. I did start to put one in a guillotine choke, but then I started thinking, man, this guy killed a lion. He's not going to tap,
right.
So I'm like, I'm not going to hurt this guy. I'm just going to play around with him.
So is he trying to wrestle with you?
And
can't figure out your sprawl.
Yeah, yeah.
You get double underhooks. He's like, what is he doing?
Yeah. They're trying a couple different kinds of, like, collar ties and trips.
Yeah.
And then they do, like, a double, almost like a tie clinch.
Really?
And so they do that, and they just kind of, like, circle each other, and they just do that amongst the warrior class, just almost like a ranking system of sorts.
So you should be able to go in there and school those dudes. And,
yeah,
like,
when it came to wrestling.
Create a whole elite team
yeah.
of Maasai warriors.
Yeah, a Kenyan wrestling team? That'd be pretty crazy.
That'd be pretty Kenyan badass. Tanzanian. That's like, you could be like your own Sandra Bullock movie. A white guy goes over there, teaches them how to wrestle, brings them to the state championship. They got leaves for shoes.
It's Mzungu.
Teaching Maasai how to fucking tap people.
Yeah.
They probably don't understand. There's, like, probably so many different techniques you can use on them they don't see coming, right?
Oh, yeah. But the craziest thing is that they have all these cactuses and briar bushes all around them. So inside the village, the wrestling was okay, but it was just, it would happen anywhere and any time. I remember I had those five-finger shoes on, and I stepped right on a briar bush, and it went straight through the sole of it and into my toe. And, I mean, just, I'm like, come on, guys, let's at least, we're used, you know, see, you just said it, like, we're used to the mats, we're used to the sissy stuff. And so those guys are just,
they're probably barefoot too, right?
Yeah, they're barefoot. I got shoes on, I got hiking boots on, I have everything.
So when they step on a briar bush and they're barefoot, they just walk it off?
I don't know. I didn't. I guess I'm the only one. Even while wrestling, I'm not aware enough to know there's a briar bush around.
They
I
must
saw
have
them.
Ridiculously tough feet too. Oh, yeah, right?
Especially with the pygmies, the Maasai too. But a lot of the Maasai now are getting sandals made out of tires. So, like, tires that blow out.
Really?
They'll make it out of the rubber from the tire. But the pygmies, they don't have access to stuff like that, especially because they don't have anything to bargain or barter with. They don't have goats. They don't have cows. And they're slaves. So they are mostly barefoot all the time. And they're running through the jungle and stuff like that. And so the soles of their feet actually almost look like the soles of shoes almost. I mean, they don't have the gripping and stuff. But they're thick. They're really thick.
Have you ever seen that show where there's two dudes? I think they call it Dual Survivor or something like Dual Survivor. Mm-hmm. I don't remember.
The Cody.
Yeah.
Landon or Landau or I don't know.
Whatever homeboy's name is. But he walks everywhere
pigtails.
Barefoot. Yep. Yeah. He's got pigtails, big gorilla looking dude.
He does it in cold weather, snow.
Yeah.
I mean,
barefoot.
Crazy stuff.
Everywhere. So
I saw the one, and because I'm trying to learn from those guys some survival stuff, which the pygmies know more than anybody, but while I'm here, you know, learning from that show, and they did, like, the swamps of, like, Louisiana or something, and there was all these water moccasins and all this stuff, and he's barefoot in there, and he's walking through. And
poisons, spiders, and all
first
kinds
time
of
I
shit.
Saw him scared. Like, he was terrified walking through that.
Yeah, one bite from one of those crazy fucking animals that live down there, and you're done. Yeah. You got a lot of that in the Congo as well. I've watched some documentaries of the Congo. I mean, this is the only place in the world where they have spiders that move in packs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and then their ants, man, are pretty crazy.
Yeah.
My buddy I took with me, he went to to take a dump behind a tree, and he put his back against the tree, and he had these ants crawl up and just start biting him. And these ants though make you bleed. They're chompers on them, like literally. And then what's the most brutal part is they try to find the softest spot to bite or something with their sensors. And so whenever they came up my leg, I didn't notice them because of how fast they are. I didn't notice them until two were on my left nipple, and I was like pulling this thing off. And I mean, I'm having to pull the ant out. And whenever I finally got it off, I literally was bleeding. Like just
from a fucking ant.
Ant. Yeah. And they travel in these things. Like I'm talking about, they look like roads. So sometimes the path that you're walking on, if it's a pygmy path, they're small, really, really small. Sometimes it's wider than the path of ants. Like, a road of ants like this thick. And I mean, the ants are only like this long and
about an inch long.
Yeah. But there's millions of them that they make these roads that are like wide that.
Ants are goddamn brutal. Terrifying.
Yeah,
and they really are. Brian Callen, a good buddy of mine, was working, I think, in Borneo, I think he said it was. I forget where it was. It was in some jungle. But he said they would have to put...
Is it in Congo?
No, I don't believe so. But they had to put turpentine over the posts of the... They had to suspend their tents, put turpentine over the posts so the ants didn't climb up them. He said, but when you were lying in bed at night, you would hear the ants walking through the forest.
Yeah, that, absolutely.
Like, you can hear them.
You can hear them, without a doubt. Yeah, I mean, that's the part. See, that's why I know I'm passionate about this and that I really feel like this is my life's purpose.
Wow.
Because I don't like creepy crawlies. I don't like stuff like that, man. And I think I sent a picture of a black mamba I almost stepped on, and luckily the pygmies killed it. It was in the middle of the night. And it was pretty crazy because all of a sudden I heard the hut next to me, which this tribe was a chief, and I heard his wife going nuts. And I would sleep with there it is. That's the black mamba. And
that almost got you?
Yeah, it was like 5 or 6 feet long probably.
Did you guys eat that thing?
I thought about it, and they believe trees and snakes are their ancestors. And so even though they killed the snake, if it's a python, they won't kill it. They won't kill a python. They'll drag it to where it's safe. The only python I've heard of them killing was whenever they had gone fishing, and then they had it almost on like a stringer of sorts, and then a big python came by and took their fish, and then the guy was so mad he killed that python. But the pygmies were mad at him for killing a python because they aren't poisonous. But the black mambas, they know how dangerous they are. I think it's like 20, 30 minutes, and you're gone. And those things can get up to like 8 or 10 feet long, and they're the fastest snake in the world.
Oh.
And they're one of the most venomous. So the fastest, most aggressive, one of the longest, and so it just seems like Congo, man, like everything, there's some of the most beautiful places in the world. I mean, the mountains covered on the equator, covered with, I mean, the most gorgeous trees, silverback gorillas. I mean, just some beautiful stuff there, but
you've run into silverback
stuff.
Gorillas in the wild?
No, I haven't. We've heard them, and we've heard definitely monkeys, but I haven't seen the gorillas.
Have you seen monkeys?
Oh yeah, a lot. Like, yeah, it's the Maasai, not the pygmies, but the Maasai actually will target practice with their rungus, their clubs. They'll throw those at the monkeys, and so
poor monkeys.
Yeah,
the monkeys get no fucking slack. It's just like the pygmies. The pygmies, the monkeys, the little guys get picked on.
Yeah, and I actually that black mamba that was up there, I heard them going nuts, and so whenever I got up and I crawl out of my hut, which, I mean, those things for me to get inside sometimes have to be on my elbows.
Right.
And so I start getting out of it, and I'm like, what's going on? And I had a video of it, and I actually cut it off right before I asked the question, but I didn't know what kind of snake it was. I thought black mambas were black, like just black, but it's actually their mouths. When they open their mouths, it's like pitch black inside their mouth. Even their like teeth are black. And so that's how they got their name, black mambas. And so, but they're gray on top and then white on their belly. And so I didn't think it was a black mamba at all. And so I was, I was getting out of my hut, and then I got slapped in the belly and stopped. And I didn't know what was going on until I got my phone on because it's pitch black.
Look at that picture.
Yeah, man, that's the thing I almost stepped on. And it's like 20 or 30 minutes and you're dead.
Oh, what a creepy looking alien-like creature.
And they had only hit it in the back of the tail, and so it was still slithering around. Actually, I'll pull up the video. I don't think I uploaded it to anywhere, but maybe my phone.
So they won't eat these, even though it's a source of protein and they're probably hungry.
No, not at all.
Are they edible, though, black mambas?
I don't know about black mambas. I know the pythons are.
rattlesnakes are actually pretty tasty.
Yeah, I think if you cut it off far enough down from its head, then I bet it wouldn't be poisonous. But they weren't going to eat it at all.
Huh.
Yeah, and then I asked on the right before this video cuts off, I asked if it's poisonous, and so yeah, I don't know if I can email this
to
you guys. So
pretty much everybody there must know somebody who's been killed by something natural in that area.
Oh yeah,
whether it's a crocodile or whether it's a lion or whether it's whatever the hell else is out there.
Yeah, the rivers close to the Pygmies are full of crocodiles and hippos. So crocodiles and hippos live in the same thing.
Oh, hippos too, man. That's another problem, right? Don't hippos kill more people even than crocodiles?
Yeah, a lot more.
I got a video of hippos and crocodiles all in the same water hole, and the hippos are like swimming right next to the crocodiles, and they don't give a fuck about the crocodiles. They're not even remotely concerned.
I don't think hippos are concerned about anything. And I don't know if you know, but they do like a bark. I mean, it literally sounds like they're barking. Like a softer bark, not so like doggish, but it sounds like a bark. And that's how hippos like communicate and stuff.
Ugh.
And so like in the morning and in the afternoon, like towards like the sun setting and sun coming up, the hippos are barking. And so you hear that. And
you're in your little leaf house.
Yeah.
And you hear these murderous giant pigs.
Yeah.
They're like, aren't they something like a pig or a cousin to a pig or some shit like that?
Probably. Yeah.
Are they?
I think they are. And I think there's even like pygmy hippos. So there's pygmy hippos, pygmy crocodiles, pygmy monkeys, which are like the size of your finger. Like actual monkeys that are like that.
Monkeys the size of your finger.
Yeah.
Are you anywhere near that area of the Congo? I think it's called Beli. Do you know where that is?
Beni?
Beli, B-I-L-I.
Beni is really close, B-E-N-I.
No, I don't think that's
Beli,
it.
I don't,
it's, have you ever heard of that chimpanzee that they found there?
Oh, the one that's supposed to be massive.
Yeah.
I've heard stories from the pygmies talking about a human-type monkey. Not human-type, they weren't talking about like Bigfoot. And if they were, I guess they're talking about me. but no, they talk about different kinds of animals. But they also talk about seeing spirits and stuff like that.
Right.
I mean, I've asked them about, I forget what they call it. There's like an actual like Swahili name that they call that that potential dinosaur of sorts.
Yeah, our friend David Cho actually went out there looking for it a long time ago for Vice. He went for Vice.com and he went to look in the Congo for like a brontosaurus.
Wow. Well, it's so crazy. There's a saying, the Congo is called the heart of darkness and on the dark continent. And the pygmies, I think, are the ones that have the saying that it's, I can't really say it eloquent like they do, but it's called, they say like it's basically hard for a fish to navigate through the rivers because of how thick everything is. And it's just hiking and everything is just, it's actually, I guess, better to be a pygmy because it's hard
to move around,
move around, especially whenever you have like an 80-pound pack on your back. I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to go. I haven't sent this picture in, but that's part of the ways that we get through like 85 kilometers hiking and stuff.
Wow.
So it's just so thick.
Yeah. People tried, some European, noblemen tried to live there. They tried to settle into the Congo because there's such a vast amount of resources. They just figured, look, we'll just carve out a little place and then make a house, and the forest just swallowed it all up.
Yeah.
They just couldn't keep off.
Yeah. I think in the late 1800s or early 1900s, that was whenever they went there for all the rubber and really slaughtered a lot of the Congolese. And then since then, they came in for the gold and diamonds, and now they're there for the coltan. And you can go through whole colonial like settlements that are from like from Belgium and other places that have settled there, and it's from like the early 1900s, and it's just almost like ghost towns, but they're like the Belgian colonization stuff, and nobody lives there. Like trees are growing up through them and everything, but they're brick buildings, and the Congolese don't live in brick buildings. A lot of them don't, unless you're more towards the city.
Wow. So these pygmies that you talked to, had they seen that big giant chimpanzee? Had any of them?
No. I don't know. Whenever I heard lots of different stuff, and normally they open up around the campfire at night. I would have to pretend sometimes to go to sleep for the Bantu slave masters or the kids to leave. And so Shalom University calls it Campfire University for the pygmies because they'll open up and they'll be real around the campfire. And they'll actually, because if I ask him in front of, I had a chief of the Bantu come to me and welcome me. It, well, first he was like, what do you want with my people? What do you want with my property? And then he, and then I told him I was just there to learn. I was with the university. We're there learning, doing research, and just here to help and benefit. And then he gave me an egg and told me he had a gift for me. And so he gave me just one single egg. It wasn't until, and I was so grateful and thankful because, you know, he gave me a gift and I was going to be able to eat it and everything else. And as I'm cooking it, and the pygmies are helping me cook it. And after I eat it, they finally tell me around the campfire after I had pretended to go to sleep and then got up to come back around the campfire to talk for hours until we fall asleep around the campfire. They finally told me, that the egg they gave me wasn't the Bantu chiefs. It was the pygmy chiefs. And the pygmy chief had saved that to give to me because he heard that a visitor was coming. And so the Bantu chief, like, just, you know, took his gift, completely stole it and acted like it was his. And really it was the pygmy chief. And he was giving me everything that he had to give me because that's food for them. Like, food's their livelihood. And that was a clean source of food. And, so yeah, it's just, it's pretty messed up how they treat them.
Wow. That's so, that's gotta be so strange for you to be around both of them, to be around the Bantu people. And
yeah.
Do you try to communicate that there's something wrong with this?
Or? Yeah, absolutely, man. And, so in six of the places I went to, they referred to them as, these are my slaves. These are my people. These are my property, kind of sorts. Mm-hmm. Three of the places I went that were even deeper in the jungle, they said, what do you want with my animals? Because they believe them to be so low class like that. I see them, man. The tribes that surround me, most of it's Bantu. Sometimes it's rebel. Sometimes it's other tribes. But they treat them worse than they treat their cattle, than they treat their goat. Well, they don't have cattle, but they have goats. And I don't know if that falls in the cattle category, but they treat their goats better than they treat pygmies.
That's insane. And they've always done this. This is just,
well, the pygmies used to never have to depend on the Bantu. So this is why, I mean, on the UG, some people have really been, they're really interested and they've been trying to find out what kind of slavery there is. And the slaves that we've been able to set free, they weren't in shackles and they weren't held to gunpoint. Like, I don't know how to do that with the rebels yet. Maybe in the year I'm there, I can befriend them. Like, I had to befriend the slave masters so they would want to learn and stuff. And so with the Bantu people, we just had to sit there and say, like, hey, you know, these are people. Like, I'm an educated guy from the United States. I'm not really that educated, but the Shalom University guys, those four guys I'm with, two have master's degrees and two have doctorates. So they're really educated and they're the ones leading the university. So I'm like, these guys are knowledgeable. And I came from the US. These are actually people, like fully human beings. And the Bantu eyes will get big, like, what? And then they'll see us treating them like humans, treating them like they have value, treating them like, you know, they're like they should be treated.
Right.
And so it starts to change some of the things. And the pygmies are more slave to the Bantu through circumstance. They used to not depend on them. They used to be hunters and gatherers and not have to worry about it. But whenever I can see the sun at times and it sounds like this earthquaking thunder going on all throughout the day, thunder going on, but I see the sun, it's not raining on me. I'm like, why is there thunder? And then we finally get close enough to where we see some of the deforestation going on. And these are trees that you could drive two Mack trucks through, you know, and they're cutting these trees down. And whenever those things fall, it sounds like thunder.
Wow.
And so the animals just flee. I mean, and I think last I heard, and I don't know that it's scientific, maybe someone can find it, but I think they said that the deforestation in the Congo, the second largest rainforest in the world, is up to the size of Texas or over Texas in the last like 15, 20 years.
Oh my God.
Last 15, 20 years, man, they've deforested the size of Texas. And I've seen it. I've gone to places where it's just big, lush, awesome forest. And then you go to this place and it's just like wrecked. And it goes from like looking like the rainforest to now it's looking like this might turn into like deserty kind of stuff because like they've just, it's barren.
And so, no one does any or makes any attempt to replenish the forest.
No, not at all. And see, that is why the rainforest conservationists, the wildlife preservationists are getting involved in ways that they're trying to buy up that land and protect it. And I agree with that. That's why I feel like what Shalom's wanting to do and what I'm wanting to partner with them. It's a all-encompassing thing where it's like human slave liberation. It's rainforest preservation and wildlife conservation. It's attractive to all those people.
There must be a tremendous amount of money that they're making from those trees, though, no?
Oh, massive amounts. I mean, some of those are very rare woods. Other things that they're using it for is charcoal. See, in the Congo, since they don't have like electric plants and things like that, they have to cook. For them to cook, if they burn up wood, it's not as long-lasting or as hot as charcoal. So I have a picture of a woman that was a slave for charcoal, and she had to – her slave master put this bag of maybe 120 pounds minimum. I mean, the bag of charcoal was taller than she was. I mean, a pygmy woman is small. I don't know if you can pull up the one Chibusiku, the picture that says Chibusiku, but – I mean, these are small people, and they're carrying bags of charcoal where two slave masters put it on their back, tie a rope around their head, and this woman having to walk 4 or 5 kilometers on these little paths carrying this charcoal. And they'll cut down the trees to make charcoal. They'll cut them down, and they'll start a fire, but they'll put, like, dirt over the fire, and it smolders, and it I don't know if it's a week-long process or a few day-long process, but it makes it just long burning. And so that's how most people cook in the Congo and in Rwanda and in Uganda and in Burundi. And those places will get charcoal from the Congo jungle because there's so much wood, they don't even think about it.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a fucking trip. So these poor people that are just recently slaved, these poor pygmies, before that, they were able to hunt and gather. They were able to do everything. Were they treated as people then?
I would say they were treated a lot better, but still, they've never been believed to be fully human. They've always thought of them as subhuman, part monkey, part part man. And the thing is that with the Bantu, the relationship the Bantu and pygmies used to have is they would trade. The pygmies were master hunters, and they still are, if there was more wildlife, especially. But they would go hunt bushmeat, and then they would come to the Bantu.
What's bushmeat?
I mean, bushmeat, like monkeys, some monkeys, also antelope, and just anything wild game inside of. So that's Chibusiku that you just put up. That's my mom in the tribe.
Whoa, that's a grown woman.
Yeah, she's in her mid-40s. She's probably as old as my mom is.
Wow.
My mom, I think, is 46. So that's Chibusiku, and she's awesome.
Wow.
That was her first picture ever taken of her, so I have some other ones where she's smiling, but that's the one that shows her her size. So that's how they got their name, Pygmy, which is elbow height.
So they really are just like the bullied people of the world.
Oh, yeah,
the most bullied people of the world.
I mean, there was times that I've gotten sick to my stomach hearing the stories that have happened to them. And that's what I was saying. They would go hunt, and then they would come to the edge of the forest where the Bantu are. And the Bantu grow corn, grow beans, and they would basically want some side dishes to go with their meat.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would trade sometimes like the wild plants that they would gather, and they would come and trade their either bush meat or their hunted animals and their different kinds of like mushrooms and stuff, and they'd trade it with the Bantu people for some corn or beans or rice or cassava leaves, which they can make ugali out of. It's like kind of paste-like thing that takes on the flavor of the meat. And they would had a trading relationship. Sometimes Bantu would go find the pygmies because they wanted some meat, and they weren't the best shepherds. And so they could grow the corn and beans, but they wanted some meat. And so that's how the relationship started. And then they started to get exploited. Whenever they could no longer hunt like they really can, the animals started fleeing. And the wildlife conservationist and rainforest preservationists are trying to push them towards the road. They made a bunch of promises. I mean, a lot of these NGOs that had their special interest would promise the pygmies, if you go off this deep forest, if you let us have this, we'll take care of you whenever you're closer to the road. We'll make sure you're taken care of. And then they just never took care of them. And then the Bantu buy up the land from underneath them and then enslave them and say, you're on our land, you work it. And so it's just kind of a whole crazy.
How do these people feel about you taking off, going to America to let everybody know about them, and then flying back again? I mean, this must be so bizarre for them.
Yeah, well, that's what's crazy. At first, I've been to more than nine, but the last time I went to nine different tribes and of pygmies, little nine villages. Each one of them had never seen a white dude before, so that scares them. I mean, there would be times that it would take an hour, maybe even sometimes a little over an hour, before someone in that tribe, most of the time it was always women or children, that would finally come up to me and touch me to make sure they don't go through me like I was a spirit or a ghost of some sort. And then once one person felt me and I'd play a game with them or something like that, then more would, I mean, literally come out from hiding behind trees, come out from the forest. Whenever I come in, sometimes they would flee, run, cry, kids like flailing on the ground, like just freaked out by me. But whenever I'd make friends with them, then they would ask me one thing. Every place that I went in all nine tribes, they asked me, will I help them have a voice? That was the thing. They're like, we have no voice here. They're the only tribe not allowed to have their citizenship in Congo. And like, so they have zero voice.
Wow. What a strange turn your life has taken. That this is, you've gone from being on the house in The Ultimate Fighter, you know, competing in the heavyweight version of the show, to now living in a grass hut.
Yeah.
In the Congo. A leaf hut, rather. Yeah. So what a strange journey you're on, man.
Yeah, and to be honest, I wouldn't change it. I mean, especially with this video going viral, and with yesterday, us talking about a book deal, and today I went out to lunch with a publicist that really worked on The Blind Side and the movie Invincible, and I forget some other big time blockbusters that he worked on. But I mean, people are saying that this is a kind of crazy story, and the whole thing is
it's a Sandra Bullock movie, man. Yeah,
there we go. I'm gonna have her play me.
That's what I'm saying. Why is Justin a chick?
Yeah.
Well, so, we polled it, and people are more likely to believe that there's more vulnerable situations. You get this giant MMA fighter going to the Congo, kicking people's asses. That ain't right.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the wild turn is, man, I just feel like it's something that I can be fully wholeheartedly passionate about, and I'm fulfilled doing it. And when I say they're my family, I mean it.
Oh, you seem very, very sincere. How old are you, Justin?
25.
So this is a good time. You don't have kids. You don't have responsibilities. You can go and just follow your desire and your passion and your interest here.
Yeah. The only thing that really, I mean, I have a future wife and
gotta find her.
What's that?
You got to find her,
no,
or she's here?
I have her. I have her in Dallas.
Jesus Christ. She's in Dallas and you're going to the fucking Congo for a year?
Yeah.
So how does she think about that?
At first she was pumped. she's done like some different trips around the world and has gone and helped orphanages in Mexico. And she kind of has a heart to maybe one day start an orphanage. Mm-hmm. And so she's got a great heart, man. She's awesome. She's gorgeous. But the first time I went, I went one time before we started dating, and then the second time I went, it was hard. It was hard for her because she started doing some research, started finding out that the Congolese people call it the African Holocaust. That's what they call it, because depending on what stat you look at, they say it surpasses the death toll of the Jews in the Holocaust, which is pretty crazy. But some stats say 6.8 million Congolese in the last 10 years. Some say over 5 million, but it's between 5 million and 7 million, man. And so it really is like one of the, if not the, it is the worst conflict zone. Last year in 2012, because then she was saying, maybe I'll go with you. And I was like, yeah. And then we'll talk about that. But the stat for 2012 was that over 400,000 women were raped in the Congo.
Oh,
it's
Jesus.
58 women every 60 minutes.
Yeah.
So
you can't bring your woman to the Congo.
No, not fuck. Especially not.
The Congo is the most dangerous Walmart parking lot in the world.
And so it's been a crazy journey. It's made us both grow a lot in our relationship too. Me being gone for that month there, and her, you know, sitting there and thinking about, am I okay? Because I had no contact. So all this different stuff. We've really been on a journey, and we were talking about even getting married before I went, and then now we're talking about waiting until I get back from the year. But it's just something I know I got to do.
Are you going to come back at all during that year?
So far, no.
Spring break.
Yeah, spring break. Actually, my girlfriend's sister is getting married, and I might want to come back for that. But
wow.
But so far, no. And it depends on my visa. Luckily, with Shalom University, I might be able to get like a student visa. I might be able to do something with a school to get a year-long visa. But if I can't get a year-long visa, I might have to come back.
And you have no income while you're doing all this.
No, man. I have... The last year and a half, man, I've honestly felt like I was just a nut. Not a nut. I knew it was right, but I felt like a lone nut. Like everybody, people be like, oh, that's really good, but why don't you go back to fighting? I've won my last three fights, and then I took some time off to go see the world and see what people I could fight for. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find anyone better to fight for than the Pygmies because they're the worst off people group on the planet. It's been a crazy journey, you know, from people, family, from close friends, all saying I'm an idiot for giving up fighting and I could actually do it well. And at Grudge Training Center, going from being invited there after the Ultimate Fighter to then being kicked off of it when I was a drug addict to then being invited back onto it. Me saying, you know, I'm gonna leave and go here. And then them being like, what are you doing? You know, my coach, Trevor Whitman, he's awesome. I love that dude.
Very good coach.
Bro, he's one of the best guys I know as a person, too. Mm-hmm. He's just incredible. Him and his wife have big giving hearts. And we set up three different hospital visits for Grudge Fight Team. I was an official volunteer at the Denver Children's Hospital. So we went there three different times as an official, like, whole team. And so that was great. That was how I started showing them, hey, I've really made a life change here. I'm no longer the drug addict that was coming in here. And we're actually a depressed, drunk drug addict. Tried to take my own life, all this different stuff. And
what were you addicted to?
What was I addicted to? A bunch of pain pills. I had three different doctors that would give me scripts. And I had one doctor that would give me 100 at a time. And I could go to all three of them, 100 at a time. No joke.
Which pills?
Hydrocodone a lot, but then also, I even got into like harder stuff like Oxy.
Hydrocodone, is that Vicodin?
Yeah. And then Oxy. And,
Oxy's the hardest, right?
Yeah, bro. I don't remember 2 to 2.5 months of my life. Like just, there's no memories except for there's one hazy memory and it was from my best friend at the time. And we're building that relationship back. My best friend at the time, the guy that got me into fighting, my first fight was because he was in the hospital and he couldn't make it to the fight. He had a staph infection where they almost thought he was going to lose his leg. It was that bad.
A lot of guys get that, huh?
Oh man. Yeah. And he got put to the side. Like they literally thought we might have to take his leg. It was deep into his, like, they thought it might've been in his femur bone.
And, oh my God. Yeah.
So he was laid up, man. And then I went to the promoter, told him he's out. Then the guy started talking trash. He just ended up in the hospital one day early. And the promoter had watched me wrestle. It was in Oklahoma. And so he knew my high school wrestling coaches, who were both two Olympic gold medalists, both wrestled at Oklahoma State, were national champions there, Kenny Monday and Kendall Cross. And
Kenny Monday fought MMA for a while.
Yeah, yeah. He was one of my training partners, too, whenever I was fighting. He's been a coach of mine since I was 15 years old. His name's Justin McCorkle. I think he's like a 4-1 pro MMA heavyweight. And I missed his wedding, not just being there, but being the best man. And I remember I had an 8-minute voicemail. I made it like 10 seconds through because it said something like, you missed my wedding. And then I'm like, oh, freak, you know? And then it paused and he goes, you missed being my best man. And then I just remember hanging up and going straight back to the drugs. And so I had my medical marijuana license for 3 years, which I'm cool with people having that. But I would always piggyback everything. Like the reason Grudge voted me off the team was I started waking up and fixing my steel cut oats, fixing my egg whites, getting my berries, putting in the steel cut oats, fixing all that, but then starting up my vaporizer before practice and then hitting the pain pills and then starting with washing it down with hard liquor, man. And so then I'd go train and they knew it. They knew that I sweated out of my pore was coming liquor.
How would you train like that?
Bro, I don't know. I mean, I was going through a literal, when I say depression, I mean like the darkest, deepest, most desperate time of my life.
And what was that being caused by?
Selfishness. I don't know, man. A lot of different things that didn't make sense to me. I grew up at 13 years old. I was heavily bullied. That's when I found the UFC. 13, I sat at the lunch table by myself, had people throw stuff at me. I was invited to my middle school crush's like birthday party, and it was a costume party. I got the invitation. I'm like, no way, costume party wins a prize. And I remember her dad worked for Dr. Pepper, and she loved Transformers. So I came to the party as a Dr. Pepper Transformer, like with the Dr. Pepper cardboard and made out of duct tape and Dr. Pepper boxes. And I got there, and I was 30 minutes late. Everyone was pointing, laughing, calling me an idiot. And that was whenever I was probably, I guess, maybe in the first fight of my life, was suicidal thoughts, because they were like, you're so worthless, you should just kill yourself.
Kids
13.
Are so
oh,
fucking
bro.
Mean.
Yeah, I mean, I left there.
Kids so mean, yeah. Man.
Oh, there's no cell phone, so I walked and I got to Dairy Queen. I lived in the country, so we like they call that the Texas stop sign, Dairy Queen, and so I went to Dairy Queen, and I think I remember one of the employees coming out to throw away trash, and I'm like sitting there behind the Dairy Queen, right in between kind of the dumpster. And then they're like, what's going on? And I was just sobbing. And then I went inside and called my mom. She wasn't there for a little bit. I had to sit in there. They asked what was going on. Anyways, that was a big left turn. But that's when I found the UFC. And I thought, maybe a few weeks after that, and I thought, these guys don't get bullied. These guys are like modern-day gladiators. I was mesmerized by the sport of it, because I loved sports and I always played sports growing up. But this was multiple sports put in one. And I'm like, man, if I could just become one of those guys, I'll have all the passion, the purpose, the significance, I'll never be this dude that I am right now. I'll be the exact opposite. And so I set out for that and started at 15, started wrestling under two Olympic gold medalists. 17, won my first national championship. 18, was living back and forth with the Olympic Training Center. 19, started fighting professionally. 21, I was on the Ultimate Fighter. 22, fighting. 23, was main event at the Hard Rock in another promotion. And I think every time I got my hand raised, and it got worse as this drug problem got on, but I stopped looking forward to even the victories of fighting and started looking forward to the parties after the fight. And then I started thinking, like, I don't know, every time I get my hand raised, if you can find a picture of me or a video of me smiling after a fight, that would be the first for me, because I don't think I smiled after any of them.
Wow.
I was always looking towards the next one. You know, most guys jumping up, smiling, screaming.
When was your issue with drugs? Was it after the Ultimate Fighter? Before?
It was before and after. It got really bad after. And I mean, it got brutal after. Actually, the week of my John, I don't know if I've ever, I told Loretta Hunt this a couple of days. I did an interview for Sports Illustrated, and the week of my John Matson fight, I was taking handfuls of pills, and I was and some guys can function and fight and everything. Me though, I would piggyback everything. If I got high, I needed the pills, or I needed a drink, or I never did one thing. That was a huge problem of mine. I always piggybacked that I had to have something else. And so I was doing that the week of my John Matson fight for the finale. Well, you were there. I was high that week. And,
wow.
And the pain pills, like lots of pain pills, like the day before. I didn't the day of.
How did you not test positive?
They didn't test me on that one. They tested me when I fought at the Hard Rock, but at that one, they didn't test. They only tested the main events.
Wow.
I think that was the time that the commission, I think the commission hit a time where they didn't test everybody on the card.
Mm-hmm.
They were only going to do like the main event fights or something like that. And then I was kind of in that window.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy, man. What would happen if they did test you?
Oh, I would have failed big time. A lot of the other guys do, but I mean, not a lot of the other guys.
But you knew you weren't going to be tested. Is that why you kept taking the pills?
Honestly,
probably would have taken them anyway.
Yeah, I would have taken them anyway. I didn't care. I never did any sort of steroids. Never. I already felt empty enough, I guess, with some of the victories. And I think whenever it got real bad was after that Roy Nelson fight on The Ultimate Fighter, and Dana and Rampage and Rashad and Coach T and basically everybody except Roy was telling me that it should have, well, that I won, or that it should have gone to a third round at least, because I think one judge thought I won, two thought he won, and it was a split, and we only went two rounds. And for me, this was my dream. And so whenever that was taken from me and I felt like it was taken in a wrong way, then what really got bad was after the Matson fight, I lost a split decision again. So two back to back, I lost it and I went straight. I mean, I don't even remember that week in Vegas.
What started you off on pills in the first place? Was it an injury?
Yeah, this right here. So
do you know how many times I've heard that, man? Well, yeah. Guy gets injured. His doctor puts him on pills. Yeah. Carl Parisian, same story.
Yep.
Went off the deep end. How goddamn addictive are these pills? And they're just handing them out to people.
I remember, I bet my mom would confirm it, but whenever this happened, I was 18 and I was living at the Olympic Training Center and I wrestled against a world champion. I didn't give up a point. It was kind of like I could have given up a point. It would have been similar to could have tapped or let it snap.
Mm-hmm.
But I just didn't want to give up a point, so I let my arm snap. And anyways, I probably took at least a month worth of the oxycodones in a week. After that, I went back, probably took 3 weeks worth.
What happened to your arm? What position was it in? It was just wrestling, right?
Greco-Roman wrestling. Mm-hmm, right. So have you ever seen a gut wrench? Like sure. Greco, how they go to turn somebody?
Uh-huh.
So I was fighting it. Posted
Explain it to people who don't know anything about wrestling.
If you don't know it, I was on my belly, a guy who maybe took me down, and once he's on your back, he goes to do a gut wrench. He wraps around your ribs, and he starts to crank down with his shoulder on the back of your shoulder blade. So you're trying to fight it so your back doesn't break 90. If it breaks 90 degrees and your back angles towards the mat, the guy gets 2 points or maybe even 1 point sometimes. But I didn't want to have my back break 90 to where he get any points. So I just let it keep fighting. And I tried to do this hop thing. And whenever I went to do the hop, that's whenever all his weight came down on it.
Wow.
Super experienced guy. He was like 33, 34. And I was 18 at the Olympic Training Center. Where he was a world champion, Olympic bronze or silver medalist. And it just snapped. And whenever it snapped, it went completely behind my back. One of my buddies at the Olympic Training Center puked because of it. And so I was laying on it completely behind my back. Like if I was on the mat right now, it was completely behind my back.
Oh.
Except it was this way. This whole part of my arm, it was wicked. This whole part of my arm was under my back. So it broke it, it dislocated it, and it tore the ulnary collateral ligament. So they did a nerve transposition, so I have no more funny bone. They moved it to where it's right here. So if I talk on the phone too long, these three nerves go numb. These three fingers go numb. And then they took cadaver. So they were going to use a cadaver.
Nerves? That's zombie shit.
No, for the torn ligament, the UCL, the ulnary collateral ligament. But then instead they used there's like three tendons in your hamstring that are kind of like this, and they took the center one out. And they said a tendon is stronger than a ligament. And like, we want to put something strong in there if you're wanting to be an Olympic caliber athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that was actually maybe a harder chance for it to take. But it was the best chance to take instead of a cadaver, which might be weaker or smaller person than me.
Your body could reject it.
Right.
Dominic Cruz had a cadaver graft 9 months in.
Brutal.
Blows it out. Has to do it all over again.
Yeah. And so they wanted to use that tendon because it was stronger. Mm-hmm. And he said, and it's going to be from your leg. And he goes, and you want to fight someday? And I go, yeah. And he said, well, this will be like you're kicking someone in the face then. And I'm like, okay, that sounds pretty sweet. So that's whenever the drug problem probably started. I remember I was piggybacking even then, kind of started going into depression because I thought, man, did I just lose my Olympic dreams and my MMA dreams? And I was doing all the oxycodone.
How old were you at this time when you hurt yourself? 18?
18, yeah.
So you're 18 years old, no drug problem before.
No.
Get on the pills
I'd smoked some weed before races. And I drank, but nothing I was never, serious. No, nothing where I had to have anything.
I have people in my family that have had the same issue. A guy got injured and all of a sudden taking pills for his back, and he's a fucking loser now. I mean, he's just gone. He's a normal guy, and now he's a loser. And I've met so many people that know somebody that has that same story or that have that same story, and then, like you, pulled themselves out of it. It's so terrifying.
Yeah.
So terrifying how they're just handing out some of the most addictive medication that the world has ever known.
Yeah.
That really is what it is.
Oh, it's brutal, man.
Heroin. It's heroin.
Yeah. And I would drive on it. I would... I know that's you. Hey, you should have that reaction. I have that reaction to me now. Looking back at my life thank God that I didn't kill somebody or family, but I remember the time that I really wanted to end it. I just took a handful of the hydrocodones. I was taking Adderall too, and then I was drinking straight. Oh, actually, I didn't drink it straight, but I had it in a Sonic cup, but it was Everclear mixed with like a strawberry slush. Yeah, brutal.
God damn, Justin Wren knows how to party. I told you, motherfucker's got a dead pig on his shoulder. That's the guy to hang out with.
And then I had my tinctures. You know what tinctures are?
Sure.
Yeah, and so I had those, and so I just took it all. Oh. I'm driving.
My God, and that's I blacked a crazy out. Combination.
Oh, yeah.
What a confusion in your mind. You had a civil war going on in your brain.
I did, and I blacked out driving. And I I've been so low that I've woke up in a drug house up in kind of outside on the outskirts of Summit County. Did you live in Boulder?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you know where Summit County is then, with like Breckenridge Keystone. So it's woke up and, I loved it.
God's country.
Yeah. I wish, I'm in Texas right now. So Congo is going to be beautiful too, but I miss Colorado.
Congo is another level. Yeah. Congo is a different level of life. It's like so vibrant and green and rainy and everything like that.
Yeah. I don't know if you know this. This is a completely different subject, but in Uganda, right on the border of where I'm at, it's on the equator.
Uh-huh.
It is the jungle. But there's mountains that are so high that they're, I think, the only glaciers that you can find on the equator. So there's like actual glaciers in Uganda, in Africa.
On the equator.
On the equator, right outside the jungle.
What the fuck?
Yeah, so there's glaciers.
That's insane.
Yeah. So anyways, that's completely random.
What made you straighten up? What made you sober up?
I knew I was going to die. Well, that was one thing.
How'd you do it? How'd you clean up?
For me personally, I had this guy that was just brutal, man. He, brutal in a way, like he was relentless. He was just coming after me, man, saying that I had a purpose to live for, saying that, you know, he told me this, and I'll always remember this. It's my buddy named Jeff Duncan. He'll probably be watching this. He's an awesome dude, man. Has a great family, great wife, great kids. And he told me, Justin, you're in the battle for your life. Like this life is a battleground, not a playground. If you treat it like a playground, you will lose the battle. And then he started talking to me like, what's your game plan for victory here? And I'm like, man, I got a perfect game plan, right? Like, I mean,
thank God that guy didn't find Brian. You'd be like, well, no battle. I'm here to play.
That's right. What the fuck? What am I going to lose at? Eating too much pussy?
And
so he told you that you have to find your purpose.
Yeah, he said I had to find a purpose and that I had a purpose.
And what does this gentleman do?
He's a roofer. So he's a childhood friend. And actually, he's even older. Like, I had some family friends and a guy that was like a second dad to me, and his kids are some of my best friends. And Jeff was kind of in that core group. But he had heard through the grapevine that my mom had come and checked on me during that like 2.5 period. And I think my dad might have came, but she had broken into my house that was in Colorado. Not broken in, but she just was able to get through the back door, saw the drugs, saw the pills, saw how I was living, and it looked like hoarders or just filthy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she knew that he might be the one guy that could get to me and get through to me. And so he called me every single day for 2 months. I mean, called me, left me a voicemail, texted me, and emailed me.
Wow.
And was pissing me off, man. I was getting livid with him.
Wow.
And then whenever I got kicked off of Grudge, I got out to my phone and got out to my car. I was like in angry tears. I didn't know what to do. Because like I was living my dream, but it was a nightmare. And my dream was reality, but it was literally a nightmare.
Right, you were living your dream as a competitive MMA fighter, but you're also a drug addict.
I had transformed successfully. I guess we can go back to that. I transformed successfully from that 13-year-old loser that was invited to the parties, and now I was that maybe quote-unquote modern-day gladiator, ultimate fighter, mixed martial artist. And somehow I wasn't fulfilled. Somehow I was a depressed drug addict. And whenever I got to my car, I had a text message, voicemail, all this different stuff. Didn't want to hear from him, but the text message said, this was when your iPhone, it didn't just say text message on it. It would say like the actual message.
Mm-hmm.
And on the actual message on the screen, it said, check your email. Checked my email. The very first thing said, game plan for victory. And then whenever I opened it up, it said the best thing you'll ever do in your life. And it was a trip that was paid for. And I thought it was maybe like a detox kind of thing or a rehab or something like that. So I was interested, and I just got kicked off a Grudge. I think Trevor was the only guy, maybe Brendan. No, I think there was like 30 guys or something. They got there early to vote on the day of sparring, to vote if I stay a part of the team, because some of the guys had it with me. And Coach T brought me into his office, and he said, bro, like, we can't have our name attached to you anymore. Like, I'm the only guy that wants you still a part. I could veto it. Maybe I'm the head coach, but I'm not going to go against the guys. And Grudge is unique, man, because Grudge is, it's a family. I mean, and when I mean, like, it's, It's like I think for Elliot Marshall, we threw a surprise baby shower for him. I mean, in fighters throwing a baby shower for a fighter, you know, like that's just not normal. And right. A lot of fight gyms they're a bunch of gym hoppers and a bunch of selfish dudes, and they're never going to give their coach the money, or they're going to try and knock out their training partners. Like we just worked like had cookouts together, all this different stuff. But I was the one guy that was the problem. And they voted me off. And so, man, I was empty. I felt like, man, now my dream, or my nightmare, but my dream, now that's even ripped away from me. So now I had nothing.
You know, I know that you've gone through some growth as a human, as a man, some spiritual development and character building and all that, but I can't help but be terrified at how smart you are and how together and passionate you are, but yet you still got hooked by these fucking pills.
Yeah.
Those goddamn things scare the shit out of me. And I know you were a younger man at the time, and you didn't have the life experiences you have now, but you're not a loser. So the fact that you got just sucked up into it like that, it's so terrifying to me.
Yeah, man, they're dangerous, man. I think they should. I don't know how they could watch it better. You know,
I mean,
I shouldn't be able to go to three different doctors and have one giving me 100 at a time.
Yeah,
I mean, you know what I mean? 100.
This is in Colorado. Yeah, where at least they have databases.
Yeah, I mean, I literally just go to three different pharmacies, three different doctors,
That was the whole topic of a Vanguard show called the OxyContin Express.
Oh, I was on it. I was aboard it, man. I was taking the train.
It's about Florida.
Oh, man.
Because Florida had these things called pain management centers, where you would go to a doctor, and the doctor would say, "What's wrong? Oh, I hurt my back." "Well, you need a prescription for pain pills." So the doctor writes it in the same facility right next to you leave the doctor's door. The next door is the pharmacy that only sells OxyContin. You go in there and you buy pain pills, and they have these fucking pain management centers, and they're all over the place. So you essentially have these OxyContin addicts waiting in line at all these parking lots to get into these places, and the places was filled. They were filled with poor people that were just hooked on these goddamn pills.
And I think for me, I mean, I appreciate you saying, like, you know, you're not a loser, smart guy, or whatever. I think,
but it's true. I mean, I'm listening to you talk. You're obviously a smart guy.
Well, I appreciate that. I think that worked in my advantage for my problem, if that makes sense. Like it fed it. I was able to
justify it.
Yeah, justify it, and also, but to the doctors even, like articulate it. I wasn't the same kind of guy they would classify as, "We got to watch this guy.
Right.
He's a professional fighter. He does have a bum elbow. He's got a back problem. We can trust this guy."
What was your back problem?
I actually, in my last fight, I herniated one disc, and I bulged another. And so I have an x-ray that they have. I messed up a bunch from the, mainly it was the thoracic, the thoracic, and then one or two of the lumbar. But I have a x-ray from those pain management places. I think I had six different discs where they put these injections into my spine. Of
cortisone,
kind of like cortisone. I'm trying to think of
anti-inflammatory, some sort of steroidal anti-inflammatory.
Absolutely, that was brutal because I was supposed to be in a twilight kind of sleep, and I woke up during it because he hit something, and I just remember and then they put some more in me, and I was out.
But we had Boss Rutan in here yesterday, and
that's awesome.
His right arm, it's like shriveled away because of neck injuries, of disc injuries.
Yeah, I used to get stingers all the time from wrestling. So
amazing how many guys. I have a bulging disc now in my neck, and it's amazing talking to people, like asking how many guys also have the same injury or similar injuries, or in their lower back or in their middle back, or it's fucking everybody.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, and man, it's easy. If you want to get it, fund your or whatever, find your addiction, and you want to find a way to feed that, you can. And,
if you want to find something to take a pill for, they'll get you.
Absolutely. Even one of my doctors was in Iowa, so two were in Colorado, one was in Iowa, and I'd go there.
Man, that's terrifying shit, but it's for a lot of people out there that might be struggling with that very problem right now listening to this, you know, hearing you, that you were able to pull yourself out of it, I guarantee you can inspire people to do the same.
Realize,
they can listen to you and go, "I want to be that guy. I don't want to be this guy that I'm now, a slave to this bottle of pills that I have to figure out how to get every week," you know?
I feel like that's one of the reasons I have that connection to the Pygmies. Like, I wasn't a slave to a Bantu, but I've definitely been a slave to something.
Right.
And so, yeah, if there is somebody that's watching, man, that you can get out of it because, there's definitely hope.
How did you do it? Did you go cold turkey?
Yeah. I ended up going on that, that kind of retreat of sorts with my buddy and he just loved on me, man, in a way that, it was genuine. It was authentic.
Where was the retreat? What'd you guys do?
Have you ever heard of the Hallmark family or Hallmark cards?
Sure.
I know they're big in Texas, so I don't know if they're big here. But it was actually their house or their ranch. And it was, they kind of donated this ranch to be for all walks of life, kind of all beliefs and for people to come there. And it was a vision of this one guy that wants to just have a place where people's lives can be changed and stuff. And man, there's like 20, 30 guys that said that they are not that said, but they literally went to war for me in my life and told me how to life worth living. And it was awkward, kind of not awkward, but just right at first I was like, what's up here? This is crazy. But for me, I had a radical change, man. It wasn't a slow process. It was like, I finally realized I have a life worth living. And my life can be for a bigger purpose than myself, than getting what I want when I want it. I can make a contribution to this planet, to this world, to people. I cannot just fight against people. I can fight for people. And that's what it was demonstrated in front of me at this retreat. And I'm not, man, I have my own personal beliefs. Everyone does, man. But this was a Christian, retreat. And for me, it changed my life, man, because these men weren't like, because bro, if you want to go into some jacked up religious background, I got it. I've got a jacked up religious background. I have family that says just come crazy stuff. Like you have instruments in your music, you go to hell. If you have tattoos, you go to hell. I'm the only tattooed guy in my family. And I have a whole back piece and all this stuff. And I had another one where, so they're super like legalistic and this and rules and this other one, when I'm 13 years old, I left a church camp, the only church camp I ever went to. I left a church camp with bruises on my neck because they tried to cast demons out of me. And then I went to Catholic school and had a background where, you know, the parents were throwing keg parties for us. And then I went there in this place, in this retreat, and I told the guy, bro, I don't need anything Christian. Bro, I don't need it. I don't want it. I know your type. Like if I sit around a campfire and I hold hands with a bunch of sissies, punks and sissies and sing Kumbaya, what is that going to do for me? I need a real answer. I need some like real hope. And man, the guy gave me an answer where it was like, you know, real people with real problems could really use a real God. And for me, that just kind of struck a chord. He told me that and this is, again, this is my beliefs and stuff, so I'm not throwing anything out there on anybody, but he told me, and it made sense to me, you've experienced the counterfeit. And for a counterfeit to mean anything, there's got to be an authentic. And he told me, you know, if there's going to be a Folex watch made, a fake Rolex, there's got to be a Rolex. And you've been around the fake stuff. You've been around the Folexes. You felt the weight of them and they broke on you. You've seen it and you sometimes got to get close enough to where it ticks or it has a smooth transition. Other times you got to actually hold it because there's that smooth transition on the Rolex instead of ticking. Other ones are so tricky. You actually got to feel the weight.
So what you're making an analogy to is the fake religious people, the people that were,
no, the people that abused me. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of religious people that abuse people, that judge people, that all this stuff, man. And for me and what this guy shared with me and what he did was he didn't look at the problems I was going through except for to help me out of them. He didn't come down on me about any of them. He didn't judge me. He didn't say you're wrong. He didn't say God hates you. He said God loves you, bro, and you got problems, and that's okay. And love God, love people. If you can do that thing, mm-hmm. it would solve all the problems. If you could love God and love people, then that would change things. And so that's what changed my life, was like, wow. And what I had to happen first was see if God could actually love me. And then I felt my own personal experience and encounter, like I felt like, man, God doesn't hate me. He might love me. And then I feel like he does love me. And then he wants me to love him back and love people. And if I can do those two things for me, that would change. It has changed my life. And I believe it will change others' lives if I can do that.
I think for a lot of people who are atheists, they hear this kind of talk. One of the things that comes to mind is they're going like, where is this God you're talking about? Yeah. Where is this evidence? to put it into the way I kind of look at it, like, a lot of people have thought, for whatever reason, that that I don't believe in God, or that I'm anti-God, or that I'm an atheist. I would not classify myself in any way, shape, or form. I definitely don't think that I'm an atheist, because I don't not believe in God. But what I think is that when someone can tune into the genuine intentions of the best aspects of any religion, whether it's Christianity, whether it's Hinduism, whether it's what it really boils down to is love and generosity and fellowship and moving towards good and bringing people together with happiness rather than moving towards bad. And what you've done in your life, you can call it God, you can call it anything, but what you've done in your life is recognize the worst possible aspects, the chemical addiction, the depression, the sadness, the failure, all the self-sabotage, and then realize there's another way to do this. I've hit the worst possible frequency, and I've also kind of barely been able to tune into this great frequency. Well, what is this? Mm. Well, knowing the lows and the lowest lows, sometimes you can really sort of extrapolate that there's a counter to that. There's 180 degrees to that, just like your friend was talking about, the Folex and the Rolex.
Yeah.
And, you know, for a lot of people that have a problem with the word God, you know, I had this guy, Alex Gray, on, who's this visionary artist, really fascinating guy. And he's also this psychedelic adventurer. And he throws around the word God all the time. And he's like, you know, we kind of have to take that word back, because the word God sort of has this bad
heebie-jeebie to it. Like,
you're talking about nonsense. But no, you're not necessarily talking about nonsense. And you know, just because you can't prove it, and just because, you know, the Bible was written thousands of years ago, it doesn't mean it's all bullshit. And the true frequency of love, the true frequency of fellowship, is really what leads to happiness.
Yeah,
you're experiencing that yourself.
Oh, man, I am. And that's what this vision is for me with the pygmies in the Congo. Like, a lot of people have misinterpreted it to where they've thought, oh, you're just going there to make a bunch of converts. You should take them a sandwich instead of a bunch of converts. Like, if you actually looked at what I'm doing, like, I'm actually doing slave liberation, rainforest conservation, and wildlife preservation all wrapped into one. Sustainable ways of life, this and that. It does not hinge around... it does not really hinge around if they become a Christian or not. If they don't, and they don't want to, and they want to worship their God, do witchcraft, do all that, fine. I'm going to love you the same way. I feel like God has put on my heart a desire to love them, and to love them well, and to love them regardless of their choices that they make, just because my choice is to love them. And it doesn't hinge around if they do what I want them to do or not. Like, they're my family. And so I want to see them be self-sustainable and all that other stuff. So it's not about like, are they going to become converts or anything like that, like,
right,
at all. It's about, I'm going to love you guys and see you guys go from being slaves to being liberated, to being free, to being put on your own land, to being able to farm, to being able to produce your own corn and beans crops, which are getting ready for their second harvest. First time in history. They're going to have their own school. You're going to be educated. Once they're educated, they can represent themselves at the Capitol. They can be citizens of the country after that.
That's,
I mean, it's just
amazing.
It goes on and on and on. And
I don't think anybody who's reasonable who listens to you would think that you're just trying to convert people because you're a religious zealot. It doesn't sound like that at all. It sounds like you're doing everything absolutely perfect with the best intentions possible.
Man,
it's a beautiful story, man. It really is. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you in here and talk to you about it. And it's become more beautiful the more I hear about it, man. It's really cool. And please come back again when you're back in town, when you're back a year from now.
Right.
Again, you got my number. Get in touch with me.
Yeah.
And let's do this again and tell me more things. What's the end game? Are you going to stay there forever?
Man, I honestly don't know. We're talking about that with my future wife because I don't think we could live there forever.
No.
There's no. But I do want to go back often. And this 1 year is my way of committing to them. And this is what's crazy, man. Like, I'm trying to find a way to turn this huge publicity or the going viral. It was on Jimmy Kimmel and TMZ and the Today Show. And now there's going to be a book. And I'm trying to find a way to go from 800,000 views to $50,000, or even maybe even $200 to $250, which I know that sounds like a ton.
Start a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Start a Kickstarter.
We're on Indiegogo right now, and we're seeing how that goes. It was before Kickstarter. It's a crowdfunding site. So it's Indiegogo.com/projects /fight-for, it's for the Fight for the Forgotten, but hyphens in between it. So Indiegogo.com/projects/fight-for-the-forgotten, but there's hyphens in between fight-for.
Damn, you're making it difficult as fuck for someone to give you some money.
I know. But or you can go to fightfortheforgotten.com, and then you hit donate, and then it would take you to the Indiegogo page.
All right, fightfortheforgotten.com. Yep. Go there, folks. Please, go there and donate some cash. That sounds... That sounds amazing, man. If we can help you, if we can help publicize things, if we can tweet things for you,
that'd be
just
great.
Let me know. Are you going to have any access to the internet while you're out there?
Yeah, actually, my buddy that I brought in with me, the filmmaker, he's got a buddy that is developing this military technology that's been picked up by him. But they can fly like drones and stuff like that from a briefcase. And you take this briefcase and you take it to remote places of the world and you set up these four squares or something like that. And inside of that, you have perfect Wi-Fi, high speed stuff. So they're trying to see if they could get that to me. Cause I've had zero contact while I've been there. So I'd love to be able to Skype with people, talk to people from the jungle of the Congo. All I would need was some power.
That would definitely help. And when you do that, please let us know and we'll tweet it and we'll get it out there to as many people as we can.
Man, that's great. The whole main goal is getting potentially. Oh well, that's actually what I would love to do is if we could get Shalom University, and it shares it at the Indiegogo page. If we could get them a research center on the land, and I'm talking about 1,200 acres of land. If we could get them a research center, then that would mean they have year-round students on the Pygmy land, and they'd be able to develop them in different self-sustainable ways of life: crops, water wells, all this stuff. College students would get credit to develop the Pygmies in sustainable ways of life. And so the big goal would be 200 to 250,000. I think it's right there and it says what it does. And it's some crazy stuff where, I mean, I'll read it real quick. And, but it's, so for 200 to 250,000, this is with the university. This isn't something I made up. This is what they've been able to say. It would literally have 3,000 to 5,000 slaves put on 5 square kilometers of perfect rainforest, 5 square kilometers of land for the $200,000 price. But then after that, it would preserve the culture of the Pygmies. It would get water wells. It would get nutritious crops growing. So not just corn and beans, but like good crops. It would have a tilapia pond that's stocked. So the corn would feed the chickens. It would also feed the tilapia and it would feed the Pygmies. And it just is a self-sustainable way of life. It could have like a earth bag home technology where have you ever seen those? The earth bag homes or the eco domes? Those things are crazy.
Yeah.
So today one of my buddies was over there having a meeting with them and they might want to support this project where for in the US, 3 to 5 men, it would only take them 3 to 5 days to build a 3 to 5 room home. And it's under $300 in the US. All it is is sandbags. You fill it with dirt and you make this like adobe that you put on the outside of it. And so we're trying to get that technology over there to them. Shalom University is like all on board wanting to do that. And so really, and then it would have that university research center there where they get, and that's the thing. I don't want this project. I don't want the Pygmies to be dependent on me. Like if I'm only there a year and I can only do a year's worth of stuff, I want this thing to be a well-oiled machine that it lasts long after I'm gone. And so that way, I don't know, I want this thing to outlive me, if that makes sense. I want it to keep going on.
It does make sense. It's a very noble idea, man. And listen, you've done an amazing thing so far, and we're going to try to help you.
Hey,
so fightfortheforgotten.com. Go there, give some money to the, what is it, Indiegogo? What is
Indiegogo.com.
Indiegogo.com. Find it, folks. You can find it. You're smart, folks.
Fightfortheforgotten.com.
Fightfortheforgotten.com. Man, you could follow Justin. He is on Twitter. It's Justin the Viking on Twitter, right?
Yes, sir.
All right. Dude, thank you very much, man. I'm
I
so glad you
guys.
Did this.
This is really one of the coolest things. Thanks.
It's one of the coolest things for us, too. Thank you very much, man. All right, folks. We'll be back most likely tomorrow with Shane Smith. We got to work out the dates and time, but tomorrow night we do have a show at the Ice House Comedy Club. And that is at 10 p.m. with Ian Edwards and Ari Shaffir. Thanks to Hover.com. Go to Hover.com/Rogan, and you will get 10% off your domain name registrations. They're a very cool company, and they help support this podcast. Thanks also to Audible.com. If you go to Audible.com/Joe, you will get free 30 days service from Audible.com and a free audiobook. And we would recommend Nocturnal from our buddy Scott Sigler, who's just in here today. Really cool guy. So audible.com/Joe. This Thursday night at the American Comedy Company in San Diego, California, where they just got their liquor. So if you want to fuck your life up and go down the hard path that Justin Wren just recovered from, go down to San Diego and take shots of Jack Daniels with Mexican narcotics, because they're right across the border in San Diego. I'm not telling you should do this.
Be careful.
But if you're going to do that, that's the place to be. San Diego, bring American Comedy Company, and lots of funny comics, and it's this Thursday night. All right, my friends, listen, the message of this podcast could not have been better served by Justin Wren today. You are you stand for everything that is good in this world, my friend, and what you're doing, I think, is a beautiful thing, and it's I'm honored to have you on this podcast to tell the world about this.
I appreciate you so much.
We're gonna have you on again, my friend.
All right,
Justin
after we set 1,000 slaves free.
We're gonna send slaves free. We're gonna put people on Mars. You telepathy. We're gonna find the Bigfoots and all more, and then some, and then. We're going to go to God. All right, folks. We love the shit out of you, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thanks. Bye.
Appreciate it.